And welcome to Bad Rip Spears Broadsides, the December 24th, day before the eve before the Christmas deal. So stay with us here on 96.3. We'll have a little chat about what's really going on the streets while they're doing the commercial deal in the stores. Ho-ho-ho to you on December 24th, 2000, Christmas Eve coming our way soon. This, of course, is your twice-weekly Bathrop Spears Broadsides show. I'm Bathrop Spear Robert Norse on Free Radio Santa Cruz here at 96.3 FM. And we spend a lot of time on the obvious, like why it should be legal for people to sleep at night who are poor, and who have no other shelter than the sleeping bag they bring with them, the tent they have on their back, or the shelter they find that no one else is using. The camping ban or the camping ordinance and the sleeping ban sections of that ordinance have been the particular focus of activists for the last couple of years, and we will be continuing that focus until these laws are changed. Trivial, stupid, and minor as it is in terms of the bigger picture of actually getting people and getting the society on the road to real recovery and transformation, this is still such an obvious human rights violation. The Santa Cruz City sleeping ban, Municipal Code 6.36.010A, that as long as it stands on the books, it seems to indicate the depths to which this city's government and police force can sink, seems to indicate what we have to deal with first, because it is so glaring, before we even turn to the next issue, although I suggest we can probably turn to a number of issues at the same time, and that, in fact, is what I do. And I want you to turn to those issues with me. My name is Robert Norse, and I'm your host for the next 2.5 hours here on 96.3 FM. The phone number, in case you want to join me, is 427-3772, 427-FRSC for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Today is the 24th. On Tuesday, the 26th, there's going to be another one of those excellent Club Cruise community television shows. I like them because I'm often hosting them, but I also like them because of the content that goes on. The kind of stuff you get on free radio, but you don't get much elsewhere in town. And not only get to hear voices, but you get to see the people. So check out Channel 27 if you've got a community TV access. Becky Johnson, for her Club Crew show, will be interviewing Kevin Clark of the AA Low Income Rental Agency, Car Rental Agency. And that's the guy that was driven off his, well, the property he was leasing. His business essentially was destroyed by city council to allow for more parking spaces for the OWS, and their expansion of the Nickelodeon, which actually didn't happen, or hasn't happened quite the way it's supposed to happen. So instead, the most, probably the best low-income, perhaps the only low-income auto dealer in town who works the way Kevin does, and he's been on the air before talking about his how his business works, was essentially driven off. And to some of us, this was just another chapter in the book of gentrification, which the city seems to be intent on doing all over town. It affects all of us, ranging from the huge rent hikes that impact middle-income people to the anti-homeless sitting, sleeping, and spare-changing bans to cosmetify the downtown, which affect low-income people. It affects everybody, this drive to attract and pander to the rich. It affects working-class families who can't buy anything decent downtown anymore because it's just a trinket alley. You know, it's a series of boutiques and coffee shops and luxury areas where you can't really where you try and find a department store downtown. It's not there. They're catering to the Silicon Valley crowd more and more, and those of us who want to continue to retain not just the quality of the town but to be able to live in this town are going to have to band together and take the steps necessary to assure real rent control, restoration of rights to the poor, get the police under community control, and do a number of other things that need to be done, but that the city council shows no indication of having any interest in doing whatsoever, in spite of its election rhetoric. It's not only true in our town, however. In Ventura, California, which is just south of Santa Barbara, about 250 miles to our south, here's a sort of a story comes out of there. I'm interested in Santa Barbara because I worked there as a homeless advocate, actually a paid homeless advocate for a year. And we were fighting the sleeping ban in a number of cities. Here's the story from Ventura. Transients warned against camping in riverbeds by Holly J. Walcott, LA Times. A team of 20 police officers and firefighters visited homeless encampments along the Ventura and Santa Clara Rivers Wednesday to hand out literature about shelters and warn campers to clear out by the end of the year. The operation, conducted at least once a year during the colder months, also allowed officers to distribute pamphlets about social service agencies and talk with transients about the dangers of flooding and fires. They told them that starting in January, they will be coming down and making arrests because it is illegal to be camping down there, said Ventura Police Lieutenant Doug Aldrich. The crime is a misdemeanor, punishable by jail time or fines up to $1,000. Our own camping ban has the same crime if you camp twice within 24 hours, but the sleeping sections and the blanket sections are now $54 infractions, though, of course, if you get a warrant, it skyrockets up to $272 and becomes a jailable offense. No one was arrested Wednesday, the lieutenant said. Transients were also informed about a warming shelter available in Oxnard this winter. Transients can reach the shelter by using a free bus that comes to Ventura. Wednesday's operation involved Ventura police officers and firefighters, as well as several mounted units from the Ventura County Sheriff's Department and employees from the city's Public Works Department. Well, that sounds pretty cozy, doesn't it? They're giving out nice, encouraging literature about warm places to stay and free bus rides and saying no one will be arrested till the beginning of the year. It's too bad I wasn't able to reach the Homes on Wheels group in Santa Barbara, and perhaps I will have an update for you by next Thursday on that. And maybe even my producer could give them a call if they're around. They're hard to reach. Nancy McCready and Bob Hansen in Santa Barbara would probably have more information about this. In fact, based on other stories I'm going to be reading you today over the air from Portland, what the police say, what the newspapers say, is often pretty clearly at variance with the facts and rather tailored and skewed to meet the sort of emotional demands of the Christmas season. They don't want to talk about busting homeless people on New Year's Eve. My goodness, that's an example of kind of unchristian behavior. One might even say it's what they did to Jesus Christ. We have an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
No, man, that sounds like a classic. Personally, that sounds like a classic case of, like, kind of like the parking meters downtown, to where they put those bags over them, say, oh, you know, we're giving you free parking, but not telling the whole truth of the stories because the meter maids need a day off.
Mm.
So since the meter maids are taking a day off, they make it seem like, oh, we're letting you have a free day of parking without monitoring. Like, we could, but we're being nice. So that and if you apply that to the situation you just mentioned, it's kind of the same thing, you know. We're not going to bust you because they don't want to jam the courts with crap during the winter calendar.
Right, but I dispute whether they're even honest about that. Again, I don't. It's hard for me to tell, and I'm speculating. The reason I speculate, though, is I'll be showing you later in the show, caller, that in Portland you're getting one story from the establishment paper, the Portland Oregonian, but then if you read the street newspaper, Street Roots, which publishes every month up there, you hear that police are continuing to bust people, essentially violating the law, because the sleeping ban up there, the entire camping ordinance in Portland, was ruled unconstitutional. So it could be that you're right, too, that they're, you know, they're getting some payback for what they do. I think, though, that this, based on what I know in Ventura and Santa Barbara from about 10 years ago, well, 8 years ago, and also based on the fact that they are really doing a huge camping ticket harassment in Santa Barbara, 200 tickets this year so far.
Wow.
It's, you know,
well, that's maybe a real high upper ritzy yeah. area any, to begin with.
Right, well, that's what Santa Cruz is becoming, you know.
Yeah, it is.
Anything
Unfortunately,
else?
It is.
Yeah.
No, that's just a real quick gab there.
Sure, thank you.
See
Paul.
You, Robert.
All righty. Yeah, do call in, 427-3772. Meanwhile, in the national scene, here's Clinton announces help for homeless. Ha ha ha. I love it. President Clinton and Republicans both struck messages of compassion Saturday, saying that they're doing what they can to help needy Americans. I'm sorry, they already helped the homeless. Uh-huh. Clinton announced measures to help the homeless and those trying to buy homes, while the GOP and President-elect Bush is committed to, quote, mobilizing the armies of compassion to help the needy. I suppose that's after they're finished bombing the Palestinians. Bush, who campaigned as a compassionate conservative, met Wednesday with about 30 Muslim, Christian, and Jewish clergy and scholars. He also has promised to create an Office of Faith-Based Action. Is that sort of a Roman Catholic division of the federal government, or is this the Baptist section of the federal government? I don't know what they would mean by that, but moving right along, I guess we'll be seeing that under Bush. Clinton, who leaves office in 4 weeks, said the Department of Housing and Urban Development is awarding more than $1 billion in grants to help more than 200,000 homeless people find shelter and become more self-sufficient. I really doubt he's granting that directly to homeless people. It's probably being siphoned off in the usual fashion. That money goes to charities where huge amounts are eaten up in the middle. The steps we're taking now will create new opportunities for the homeless, for hard-pressed working families, and for those struggling to buy their first home, the president said in his weekly radio address. Clinton also announced a rule requiring public housing authorities to do more to integrate public housing projects, with Housing Secretary Andrew Cuomo adding in a statement, Uncle Sam's own housing should be a model of integration. Under the rule, public housing agencies must survey clients and try to provide a mix of income levels in different buildings. Cuomo said the rule would apply only to new tenants and not affect people already living in public housing. This will help break down destructive barriers of race and class, Clinton said. Again, hard to make a judgment on this unless you have the specifics. In addition, Clinton said the government is raising the maximum amount people may borrow from the Federal Housing Administration to $239,250 from $219,000. So you better rush out there and try to get your federal loan, folks. You're going to need it if you want a house in Santa Cruz. Graves, in the Republican radio address, said faith-based programs, that's sectarian religious programs, folks. Faith-based is a code word for government aid to religions. That is to say, it's the word for toppling the First Amendment's prohibition against an establishment of religion, which, of course, radical right-wing Republicans have been pushing for many a moon. Graves said in the Republican radio address that faith-based programs in his state in Texas, where Bush was governor for 5 years, are innovative partnerships that will work. In Kansas, the state's social service agency turned its foster care and adoption programs for abused and neglected children over to private, nonprofit religious groups in 1996. Bush promised during the presidential campaign to make it easier for spiritual, they find all kinds of synonyms for religious, spiritual organizations to help the poor, and said government money should go to such groups. Critics said such an arrangement could raise constitutional problems of church-state separation. Graves also said Bush's choice for the cabinet and other major positions of the administration reflect a commitment to diversity, or perhaps diversity. Who knows? And here's a story from the Washington Post about Santa Barbara and mentioning our very own mayor, Tiny Tim Fitzmaurice. I say tiny because Tim likes to have this kind of God bless us everyone, passionate Mr. Poet from the city on a hill quality to him, this humble self-presentation, which I think is so much at variance with the kind of political platform he's pushing. But before we get into that story, here's a call.
Hi, Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Did that last story, let me just see if I got this right. It basically means taxpayers' money that go to churches so they can pray for us.
Oh, they would say that they are providing services for us.
Okay, so they're praying for us.
Mm-hmm. Or praying
Damn,
on us.
I hate when people do that. They're famous for that.
It has to be said that
money for prayers, man.
Well, it has to be said that in Santa Cruz, the only emergency shelter program previously was the Interfaith Satellite Church program, which wasn't much. It's like 56 spaces on the floor.
Yeah, but those are church members, not the church hierarchy.
Well, those are the organizations of different churches in Santa Cruz, although I got to say, not even a majority. In fact, a small minority of churches participates in the program, but there are a number who do. So I want to not tar everybody with the same brush here. There are plenty of good Roman Catholic people in jail for fighting nuclear weapons and
yeah.
for fighting capital punishment, and I my hat's off to them, too.
I'm talking about the evangelist crowds
right.
that governments seem to palsy around with.
And I want to say also, you know, just being the devil's advocate on them, there are a strange number of bedfellows, so to speak, that I've had over the years who are adamantly against freedom of choice, but who also stand up very strongly for homeless people and be arrested for their right to sleep at night. So it's kind of a strange contradiction you find there, too, sometimes.
Yeah, it's definitely a cloudy area.
Yep.
Okay, Robert.
Sure.
Here's a story from, actually from Santa Barbara, but written in the Washington Post. Tarnish on the Gold Coast by Renee Sanchez. In an empty, windswept parking lot near the Pacific Ocean, James Williard leans against the cluttered old camper he calls home and describes his peculiar plight. He has given up looking for an apartment or a house in this ever more affluent coastal city because finding either for a price he could afford seems futile. Even the few ramshackle downtown hotels that once offered the needy cheap places to live for months have been retailored for wealthy tourists. And he keeps getting more neighbors. In numbers startling local officials, the streets of Santa Barbara are filling with permanently parked campers that are becoming last resort housing for the working poor, disabled veterans, or elderly on fixed incomes, all victims of California's latest gold rush. "This is the only choice we have left," said Williard, 41, who receives $750 a month in government subsidies for a disability. "It's as if there's no room for anybody but the rich around here anymore." That lament is resounding up and down California's coast. Like few other regions in the country, it is in the strange position these days of suffering in some ways from too much economic prosperity. For this city and others, the wave of wealth is bringing as many headaches as benefits. So many coastal residents with moderate salaries or less are being displaced that the state is in the early throes of a reverse exodus, this time away from the sea into more affordable areas far inland. The last trailer parks in Silicon Valley are closing. Modest seaside cottage communities south of Los Angeles are being razed and replaced by resorts. In Santa Cruz, the mayor nearly had to quit and leave town because he was having so much trouble keeping up with rental costs. I think actually that they're talking about I hadn't heard that it happened to Sugar or Fitzmaurice. Those are our two most recent mayors, or excuses therefore. Rather, I did hear that Area Chamber of Commerce head Michael Schmidt was on the edge of leaving Santa Cruz because his rent had been essentially doubled in the last year and a half, or up by 50% to 75%, one of the two. However, he was able to find other accommodations, so Schmidt isn't leaving. In Santa Cruz, the mayor nearly had to quit and leave town, as I said before. In San Carlos, the mayor just did. And all along the California coast, local officials are struggling to secure public access to beaches lined with new estates, some with owners going to court to make the sand and surf nearly private. We have an incoming call here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, I just was listening to your program. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I'm enjoying it. One thing I thought I'd mention in you're talking about the economy and stuff and people having trouble with finances and stuff, I think that one of the big problems, especially this time of year, that really drives people into debt is the whole Christmas consumerism thing.
I agree.
You know, we're being all locked into this whole kind of mantra that you have to go out and buy stuff for people.
And are you buying gifts this year yourself?
No, actually, 25 years ago, I told all of my relatives, my friends, that what I would really like is, what I really felt was, what I needed for Christmas was just love. So I encouraged people not to give me any presents, and I said I wouldn't give them any presents. What I really would like is, like, maybe, you know, a handwritten poem, you know, their own creation, or just give me a hug, you know, something, you know, that was really a reflection of, you know, love and caring.
Are they remembering what you've asked them for? I mean, do you actually get that around Christmas time?
Yeah, I had, I really struggled with my dad for quite a while because he kept sending me stuff, but finally he stopped sending me stuff, and now I just get cards and stuff, and I really enjoy it. I remember when Christmas used to come every year, I was like, I was really facing it with foreboding, you know, like, oh God, now I got to go into debt and I got to buy all this stuff and I got to think about what people might want, and it was just a real nightmare. And now it's like, it's just so, it's like I really enjoy the season, you know. It's like I do a couple of things for nonprofit groups, you know, some volunteer work, and I really feel good. It's like I don't feel really sick. I used to get really sick every Christmas because, you know, I get all this, go through all these emotional things, and you know, I'd go and visit my relatives, and they just have all this candy and chocolate crap and all this garbage that they wanted, kept trying to get me to eat, you know, and just make me sick to my stomach.
The dentist's helper.
Oh, yeah. And so anyway, I just thought, you know, a suggestion I might make for other people is that I found this really liberating, and I think that it, you know, something that people could do to combat this really sick, you know, Christmas consumerism hype that, you know, is just everywhere is to really, you know, you might think of trying that thing that I did and, you know, offer creative and non-consumerist activities to their loved ones, you know, like I said, writing a poem or just, you know, really just give someone a hug, you know, tell them you love them or call them up and tell them you love them, you know, because it seems like love is in such a short supply in this world, and we really need a gift, we really need to give that gift instead of just more junk from the store.
Yeah, it's a strange substitution, that kind of stuff. You think somehow that can do it when, of course, everyone else is doing it, so, you know, the pressure to do it is on. But I know when I was organizing sleeping ban repeal protests, one of the thoughts we had was setting up, having people come down with their vehicles and bring thermoses of coffee and, I don't know, coffee is such a hot thing, maybe orange juice, and something hot at night.
Yeah.
And just sort of saying, here, you're not allowed, you know, you're not allowed to sleep after 11, but you can come and sit in the car and talk and hang out. Here's a blanket. And it's sort of like, not even, you know, here, I'm going to give you this charity, but more like, here's a service, you know, and also a way of saying to the rest of the community, why can't people have their basic civil rights restored? This is, you know, is one of my big deals. I'm concerned about this sleeping ban law. And I think that one way of showing a Christmas spirit, I mean, some people do it by going to the Veterans Hall and doing their service tomorrow at noon. There'll be probably scores of people giving away these delicious dinners, which happens twice a year, you know, the rest of the time.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there actually is a lot of food around Santa Cruz, although the food, you know, requests are just, you know, going up and up and up all over the country. It's kind of strange, not because there's a food shortage, because, you know, people just, it's not distributed properly, and people just can't get access to it. But I think that your point is really well taken, that, you know, we are operating in a society where money is the deal and where people have to buy and sell in order to survive. And you know, in a way, it's hard to blame the merchants as human beings because they're just trying to make enough to pay their mortgages or, you know, even their rents in some cases. And it's sort of a circular death syndrome almost.
Yeah, there's a good explanation for that. I was reading this book on the history of advertising, and about 1921, these business consortiums in the United States hired all these psychologists and sociologists and stuff, a bunch of PhDs, and they basically wanted to, you know, analyze the American psyche, you know, and like how, what the parameters of, you know, people's choice mechanism was, you know, and how they, you know, kind of what inspires them to buy things. And anyway, what they did, they basically figured out how to reprogram the American psyche, which was basically once one of thrift and
prudence.
Yeah, it was like you know, people really did a lot of stuff on their own, you know, in their own home. They made their own clothes and stuff. And what they basically did is, you know, through, I'm sure you've heard of the term called store-bought.
Yeah, although it hasn't, what significance does it
have? Well, that comes from the 1920s. That was part of the big ad campaign, was they basically reversed a lot of American values, you know, where like people took pride in their home craft stuff, you know, homemade clothes and stuff. Well, this big advertising campaign came out where they really put down things that people made themselves, you know, or, you know, in their families, and like the whole term store-bought meant that if you had something, you know, homespun and store-bought, that was the term, you were nothing. If you didn't have store-bought things, you know, you were just a country bumpkin, you know, that's where...
It's interesting you should say that, caller, because at the same time in India, there was a massive campaign where hundreds of thousands of people began spinning their own cloth.
Mm-hmm.
To under Gandhi's using Gandhi's example to protest effectively protest, you know, British exclusionary policies and imperialist policies in India. So it interestingly, while the United States was going one way, the Indian poor were going another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, self-reliance. Well, see, that's the whole thing of and also the American people at that time in the 20s had a very high savings index. There wasn't very much debt in the American economy because people had, you know, were really into saving money, you know, putting away for something and, you know, and then buying it, you know, not buying on credit or anything. And they turned that around to where people bought stuff on credit, you know, they had the layaway plans, you know, all this.
Do you have any texts that you want to suggest that people read that you think are good sources for information?
You know, I can't remember the title of the book. I read some of it in the bookshop Santa Cruz. It was called History of Advertising.
But
I think that was the title. But it was an incredible eye-opener. And you could just, and then, of course, after that, because of the rise of indebtedness of the American public, they had the 29 crash just 8 years later.
Mm-hmm. And plus the down and dirty, swift and slick Wall Street practices, which apparently are now, you know, coming back again, big time. I know people have been predicting the fall of the market for decades, and almost wistfully, you know, but it seems to be this sort of endless cycle upward. I don't know. Go ahead.
Sure made a bump this time.
Yeah? Bumpty bump.
Yeah, one thing I thought I'd mention is I go to Cuba quite often, and I help, I take computers with me, and I teach students at the university there. And one thing I found really interesting is that even though they are incredibly poor because of the, you know, 40-year blockade, you know, and the United States intimidating their trading partners, and you could go on and on, but you know that there are no, you know, like here in the United States, we have homeless people, and there's all this charity stuff, you know, and, you know, they don't have any of that in Cuba. They don't have any homeless people living on the streets.
So I hear the prostitutes are returning, is what I heard.
Yeah, they have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because of the return of the tourism and the dollar, and, you know, there's a lot.
I should say sex workers. I mean, the prostitutes are, to me, the big tobacco companies that are.
But the, you know, they do. They have had a rise in prostitution, which they're trying to deal with. But all I'm trying to say is, as a society, they don't have. Charity organizations that go around, you know, struggling to, you know, with soup lines and stuff like we have here in the United States, because the government makes it, you know, the major priority as the welfare of the people. And so you don't have these situations where you have, you know, all these people. I mean, you'd think that in a poorer country than the United States, far poorer, that if you would think that the impact on the poor would be much greater than here in the United States. You'd think that there would be an exponentially greater number of people on the street, right? Because it's a much poorer country, but it's just the opposite. They don't have homeless families.
Well, I found when I traveled in Latin America and in Nicaragua, actually I was down there in 1987 with Bikes Not Bombs.
Uh-huh.
And I found that the folks there were willing just to share what they had, whether it was, Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua. Honduras, they had lots of people dressed up in Gestapo uniforms with machine guns, but that was another matter. But, you know, in all these countries, poor people seem to be much, and maybe it's, I'm sure, I think it's true here too. People who are poor are willing to share what they have, and the people who are not so poor often are just clambering to, you know, afraid of sharing what they have. You know.
Interesting. The richer people get, the less generous they are.
Well, the more, I think, as you point, getting back to your original point, they focus on these false consumer values that having all these, you know, goods.
Oh yeah.
Is somehow gives them more fundamental spiritual security, which I don't think is true at all.
Notice it's called goods.
Right.
Yeah.
Or they're bads, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that if you focus on, you know, material acquisition, that you think you're going to be more happy, and the reality is that it dawns on people like that they aren't more happy. You know.
And the irony is that the Christian celebration of Christmas, which is supposed to be a celebration of a fundamental disavowal of the value of material wealth, has become the basis, you know, has become the hugest commercial getting time of the year for the businesses here in Santa Cruz, I'm sure in other cities as well, all over the place. Is there anything more that you want to say? I'm going to roll along otherwise.
No, go ahead. I might mention a few things. Thanks a lot.
You did.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
That's if I can avoid the squealing microphone. And thank you, caller. Calling lines are open. That's 427-3772 if you want to call in. I'm going to continue reading the story I was reading earlier. Tarnish on the Gold Coast by Rene Sanchez, Washington Post staff writer. From the venerable Volkswagen bus so plentiful on coastal highways, a mellow symbol of freedom a generation ago, it's just becoming another roadside sign of desperation, the only roof that some residents can afford over their heads. This is the biggest issue for every city on the coast, said Tim Fitzmaurice, Santa Cruz's mayor. It's painful for a variety of people who have been here for a long time. There's no way to keep up with how fast it's all changing, and there doesn't seem to be a magic bullet to fix the situation. I have to stop here in this story because Tim Fitzmaurice, of course, has the magic bullet in terms of decriminalizing homelessness in Santa Cruz, particularly in vehicles. He and three others had that vote until one of them ran away, Catherine Byers, because of business pressures from Plantronics, Texas Instruments, and some Mission Street Extension businesses last June. But now they have a new city council, and if the same three members of the city council, Sugar, Fitzmaurice, and Crone, who voted for the safe sleeping zones, were to hang tough, they would get two or three more votes. But in fact, they lack the political guts to do that. They have decided that they would get too much criticism, and so they're willing to allow people to suffer, and they're willing to make this kind of canned chatter rhetoric that Fitzmaurice is making in this article. It should also be said that Fitzmaurice was the man who proposed a initiative to the city, I guess it's not the city charter, it's to the city law code, that would have made the sleeping ban worse for people in vehicles. It would have said not only can't you sleep in a vehicle after 11 o'clock at night, which is now the case, but you also cannot be in a vehicle on public property after 11 o'clock at night. Fitzmaurice is also the author of the notorious 72 hours and get out of town law, which was passed in 1999 when people were trying to actually change the sleeping ban. Thousands of people had signed the sleeping ban initiative repeal. Thousands of voters, registered city voters, not enough to get it on the ballot because of numerous things, but certainly thousands. And Fitzmaurice, in the little bit of kind of the crumb dispensing procedure that went on in February of 1999 under Catherine Byers' direction, with Fitzmaurice, Cronin Sugar all dutifully lined up, hats in hand, not willing to challenge their leader, Catherine Byers, and still following in her footsteps, apparently. Fitzmaurice proposed that you'll be able to sleep in a vehicle on private property in a person's driveway if you have his written permission or her written permission and the written permission of the owner as well, but only for 72 hours each month, each calendar month. It's kind of hard to believe, but that was the Fitzmaurice 72 hours and get out of town. And it's said that way because it's kind of hard if you got relatives coming to town and they park in your driveway, and you're after 72 hours, what are you going to do? Go to the next neighbor and say, "Hey, can they park in your driveway?" That's not how it works. And of course, we're talking only in private driveways. You try and park on the public street, that's a crime. That's knock, knock, knock at midnight. That's flashlight shined in on you. That's get out of the car, pat you down for weapons. Here's a ticket. That's a $54 ticket, $272 failure to appear if you don't make the court date. That's where do I go? I don't know, but get going. That's what all that is. And we've heard some chatter about a possible minor reform coming up in January that Ed Porter is floating that will say that the armory, which now is considered to have a capacity of 100, they'll lower the apparent capacity to 80 and say if the armory is considered full, tickets will be dismissed. That's nice, but it won't stop the midnight wake-ups. It won't stop the rouse. It won't stop people from being moved around. It won't stop any of this stuff. What's needed to stop it, of course, is you and me and a fundamental just say no to this kind of institutionalized human rights abuse.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
You forgot. Hey, wait a minute. Before you go, you got a warrant. Have a seat right here while I clear this.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Thank you, caller.
So I interrupted my reading of this story because Tim Fitzmaurice is quoted, and he, of course, is the man with the keys to the lock here. He is the mayor of the town, and in Santa Cruz we have a weak mayor system, so he's first among equals. But if he were to put on the city council agenda, call a special session saying we need to end the sleeping ban or open up the parks or take some other emergency action to deal with the 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people outside every night where there are only 160 of them have any legal place to go, 100 in the armory and 60 on the floors of churches, the other council members would follow suit. He is hence responsible. And it's just as simple as that. And that's the reason that on Tuesday, December 26th, for the 16th day, there's going to be another continuation of the City Council Coffee Clatch and Tag Team Teach-In. And that's where we show up with coffee and donuts and maybe a sleeping bag or two, maybe a bathrobe or two, some signs, and we just wait in the offices and say we want to talk to council members about holding a special session. We want to understand what your solutions are if you don't want to end the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance. If you don't want to allow for a low-income campground, what is your solution? Well, we've heard something floated by Ed Porter about some double-wide trailers that'll house 7 people. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm glad that Ed is looking for a place to house 7 people. But it sounds more like political grandstanding than it does like any kind of meaningful change that thousands of Santa Cruzans have been seeking for the last decade, some of us for the last 22 years since the sleeping ban was passed in 1978, 1 year before Rotkin got into power and made it a misdemeanor if you do it twice. He supported the misdemeanor provisions of that law, and so does the current city council. No one is moving to make camping a non-misdemeanor, even though families need to put up tents, families need to have somewhere to shelter themselves in the rain. There is no place for them to go, and for Fitzmaurice to babble about a family shelter down the road for a small number of those people is to ignore the problem now. And I encourage people to give a call to 420-5017. However many times you've done it, it needs to be done again. And it's something that the city council will hear, or some of them. That's their hotline or their cold line, I don't know if we call it that, 420-5017. The phone number here, however, if you want to talk to us on the real hotline, is 427-3772. I eventually got the right one. 427-3772 is Free Radio Santa Cruz's on-air number, and we are open for commentary, comments, and thoughts of all sorts. Continuing, rising rent in the poorest part of Santa Cruz have prompted the city, Santa Cruz, to help some residents pay the new costs. No, they're talking about helping them pay the new costs. That's the Gutierrez apartment question that we actually, I was going to play for you today. At the last city council meeting, people properly complained that their rents were being skyrocketed in the beach flats and a couple of these apartment buildings. And Sugar made some brief motion to try to do something, but it got stalled until second week in January, where some of them may be out. So, who knows? Earlier this year, the city began allowing people to live in recreational vehicles if they parked in industrial areas, but community complaints scuttled that plan. Actually, Catherine Byers scuttled that plan. Some coastal cities also are worried that their middle-class residents are beginning to flee. So many firefighters, paramedics, and other public safety employees on the coast are moving so far away because of housing prices that there is new concern they might not be able to get back to town in an emergency, such as an earthquake, when they would be needed most. Whenever it approves development, California's Coastal Commission is obligating builders to help pay for campgrounds or other free public facilities along the beach. But by law, now there's an interesting suggestion, how about requiring developers in Santa Cruz to also build campgrounds as they build their fancy housing? That would be nice. But by law, the commission cannot stitch affordable housing requirements into any deal. Some citizen groups upset with the scope of coastal development are trying to take matters into their own hands. In Malibu last month, residents approved a ballot initiative making any coastal project greater than 25,000 square feet subject to voter approval. So far, hardly any of the moves are stopping or even slowing the change coming to the coast. A lot of these old beach communities are going through a metamorphosis, said Peter Douglas, executive director of the California Coastal Commission. Property owners are getting offers they can't refuse, and cities can't tell people you can't sell. This new wealth is having a tremendous impact. Here in Santa Barbara, which is about 90 miles north of Los Angeles, the predicament is getting dire. The city has long shimmered with affluence. Its hills overlooking the ocean are lined with beautiful homes owned by the rich and famous. But like most other communities along the California coast, it has always had a rumpled and rustic side, too. That is disappearing fast. One-bedroom apartments now rent on average for more than $1,100. Median home prices hover around $500,000. Waiting lists for local subsidized housing programs are long. And a few hundred rooms in discount hotels that had allowed open-ended stays are no longer available. Many lower-income residents here have but two options, buy a used camper or leave. Dozens of weather-beaten RVs are parked bumper to bumper on streets in industrial parts of Santa Barbara or in parking lots on the edge of town. People see those campers and think they're on a recreational trip, but they aren't, said Marty Blum, a city council member. We have a real problem in our hands, and the city is not sure how to deal with it. There are a few RV parks around the area, but they limit stays and also can be costly. For many years, it also has been illegal here to camp overnight in an RV on a city street. In recent months, police have issued nearly 200 anti-camping citations and have rousted many others from their parking spaces. At one recent court hearing on such a case, one official even suggested that the campers pack up and move 100 miles inland to more affordable cities such as Bakersfield. Dismayed by the crackdown, a Santa Barbara lawyer has begun waging a one-man crusade to shame the city into easing up on the anti-camping citations and to find new solutions to the housing crisis. He has persuaded city prosecutors to drop their cases against about 24 people living full-time in campers. Glenn Maurer, who retired last year as the director of the city's public defender's office, is urging local officials to recognize RVs as low-income housing and to create sites where the homeless or poor can park their makeshift mobile homes for lengthy periods of time. He said most people living in campers on the street are not transients, but long-term residents on fixed incomes or with low-wage jobs. Buying an old camper can be cheaper than 2 months' rent. I guess it's tempting to tell them to get off the street and move somewhere else if they can't afford it here anymore, Maurer said, but there's something outrageous about that, too. One proposal being reviewed by the city would allow churches to designate spots in their parking lots for campers, as they do in Santa Cruz, but only 3 vehicles to a parking lot, and only about a dozen churches have been involved in that program. With private groups donating portable toilets or paying for security, Santa Barbara County, meanwhile, is considering reserving a parking lot somewhere in the area for indigent campers. Maurer, who I didn't speak to directly, but I talked to people who were working with him in Santa Barbara when I went through there, has been successfully fighting camping tickets in Santa Barbara in court. Those are the sleeping ban and camping ban tickets there. Using a thing called the ICORN defense, or the threat of the ICORN defense. What he got from the court was the statement that everybody who is faced with a camping ban citation has the right to a necessity defense, to use the necessity defense. And the necessity defense is a special legal maneuver which is usually rather complicated and has six different conditions you have to prove in order to get it implemented. You admit you are guilty of the crime. You don't use the reasonable doubt defense where you say there's reasonable doubt whether I'm guilty of this crime. You say, no, I'm guilty of the crime, but I had to do it because there was a greater evil and I had a necessity to do it. And the necessity defense requires, as I've talked about on the year before, proving a number of conditions, that there was a greater evil, that you had no other course, that you didn't contribute to that evil by what you were doing, and so forth. And it's a rather complicated defense. But the courts have ruled that in the case of people who are engaging in life-sustaining behavior that is criminalized by city municipalities and state laws, many cases for cosmetic purposes, though the cities and states say public health and safety, it's not obviously the public health and safety of the homeless, but you can use the necessity defense. And when I was up in Marin County about a week ago, I talked to a group of homeless people who are considering using the necessity defense in San Mateo? No, that's the San Rafael. And they had read about it in the monthly Street Spirit newspaper, which you can still get here in Santa Cruz on the streets, or if you can't find it on the streets, call 423-HUFF. And the ICORN defense is being used in Santa Barbara. The threat of the ICORN defense caused a lot of the city authorities to stop and drop their tickets against the vehicles. But, of course, most people don't know about the ICORN defense. Most people don't have a lot of time to spend preparing a defense. They just get a ticket, and they have to go about their lives. So it's not a solution. But what is a solution, of course, is to get the law changed or to get the law overturned, as happened in Portland and Austin. We have another call.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, things getting bounced out like that out of court, tickets repeatedly getting bounced out, took it to a point and then left. The officers that are involved in the actual case, they get attitudes toward those particular homeless people who they've rousted, and they just continue to roust them because they think nothing happened. That's not justice enough.
Mm-hmm. I think that I've heard that frequently from... Well, let's put it this way. I've heard that from enough individual people that they were pursued by particular officers. In one case, Lieutenant Habey. In another case, Officer Perry. This is in the last 6 months, that I'm really concerned that you're talking about police officers using a law to kind of enforce their own private code of justice. And that, of course, is something we can't permit.
If you didn't give me your due courtesies in public, I know where you live. I know where you sleep.
Of course, the police officers don't have to live in our community, so they can go live and sleep wherever they want and then come in, harass people, and leave. And ironically, Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, his complaint about our protest for the last 2 weeks is that we are harassing his staff by being there because it's a burden on them to take our notes, asking that they schedule a special session of the city council. But
it's a marathon issue, Robert, and you've been consistent in it, I do believe.
Thank you.
You bet.
Consistently unsuccessful, perhaps, but let's not get into that. One can always hope that you're unsuccessful until the day you're successful, so perhaps that day will come with everybody's involvement. One proposal being reviewed by Santa Barbara would allow churches to designate spots in their parking lots for campers, with private groups donating portable toilets or paying for security. Santa Barbara County, meanwhile, is considering reserving a parking lot somewhere in the area for indigent campers, but even officials who are eager to help wonder if these ideas are good ways to do it. There are a lot of questions, Blum said. We know that somehow we have to maintain a better balance between the rich and the poor here, but we also don't want to wind up just creating bad housing for them. For now, the poor here sound resigned to their fate, parking in areas where they hope the police will pass them by night after night, or accepting tickets as just one more burden in their rough new way of life. I could try to pay what they want for rent here, but then I would never be at home anyway, said Kim Kraft. I'd never be at home anyway, said Kim Kraft, 28, a clerk who's been living in a camper near Highway 101 for nearly 2 years. I'd always be working to get enough money. Her neighbor in the parking lot is James Williard. He said he would prefer to live in a house or a tenant hotel, but has lost hope of finding one. He does not want to live in a shelter either. If you put all the people living in RVs into shelters, there wouldn't be any room for the homeless, he said. Most of us don't want to bother anyone. We just don't have a regular home. If I could find one for me and my dog, I'd give you my camper today. No one can, though. It's as if they just want poor people out. But it's nice here. We don't want to leave. That's an article from the Washington Post, December 23rd, yesterday. Dateline, Santa Barbara, California. So, we do have phone lines open, and I do invite you to give a call to 427-3772. We have our steady, faithful callers, but it would be nice to get a few more. And this is your opportunity to speak not just to me, but to anybody out there in the community you think should know what's on your mind on this issue. I know it's discouraging. I know it's particularly ironic and contradictory at a Christmas time, the Christian ceremony when people are supposed to be filled with joy and love and thankfulness and that sort of thing, and gratitude if you're a Christian for the arrival of the Savior, as the Christians believe. But I think basic civil rights in Santa Cruz need some saving, and I would encourage people to think about putting aside a little time for that project. Come on down to City Hall on Tuesday at 10 o'clock. Bring some warm clothes. Bring some signs, bring a book, and give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's the phone number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And we can slot you in at a time, and you can sit there for an hour and ask the mayor to get off the dime. And also, more important than that, I think we can move this to a bigger venue. We're talking about maybe a tent city there at City Hall or down at the Town Clock or another place that will dramatize and make really visible what needs to be done.
Hi, you're on free radio.
Jesus was homeless too.
Yes, well, he probably was a Huff member before his time.
I almost said Huffless.
Thank you.
Huffless.
Yes.
Oh, man, that would have been funny, but homeless. Jesus was homeless too.
And then probably a little huffy.
Yeah. I hope he didn't huff anything.
All right.
Oh, remember, God hates sinners, and that's why he sent Christians to annoy us.
Okie doke. Bye-bye.
Indeed. Sinners and repeat phone callers. Although, hey, any port in a storm, folks. 427-3772. Give a call in, and let's hear what's on your mind. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 24-hour free radio for the Santa Cruz area. No commercials, no bullshit. We're here, you're there, but you can be here too, 427-3772. So, this City Council Coffee Klatch, so-called because we bring coffee in the morning with pastries, donated by actually a few fine cafes who apparently either don't like the sleeping ban or they somehow feel around Christmas time be nice to give homeless people something warm, something hot to drink, and something hot to eat. And the idea of lobbying government officials to change oppressive laws is not a bad idea. So at 10 o'clock on Tuesday morning, we're going to be showing up there. And that's at 809 Center Street. For folks who don't know where City Hall is, the City Council office is room 10 is where all this happens. The progress of this vigil is kind of interesting to follow. I'm going to play you a little bit from the Thursday experiences on December 21st, 3 days ago. Usually what happens is you have two or three of us sitting in the chairs in the council offices right inside the door where it's a public area. People are allowed to sit, and if you want to try and talk to a council member as they come through, you can ask them if they've got time, and leave a message with the secretary for a council member, and read the newspaper while waiting for the council member to come, and actually hang out all day waiting for the council member to come, assuming you're not disrupting the office business. Now, of course, Tim Fitzmaurice, our mayor, long ago got very tired of this whole thing, and he has now been accusing us regularly of harassing his staff and disrupting the council members, and shouting at the top of our lungs. That was a quote from the Metro Santa Cruz of a week or two ago, which I tried to respond to in a letter, but for some reason it just never made its way into that fine weekly. But no, we don't shout at the top of our lungs. We're rather nervous, actually, in there, and our voices are often lower than those of the secretaries who work there, because we do recognize that even though those offices should belong to the public, they actually are under the control of bureaucrats, politicians, and the police. So we have to realistically respect that reality, even though we are attempting to give the public a sort of a foot in the door there and remind the politicians that they may be having all kinds of fine turkey dinners at home and exchanging gifts with their family and all those wonderful things. But because they refused to act on December 12th to do anything about the sleeping ban, a lot of people are cold, a lot of people are harassed, a lot of people are afraid, and a lot of people are just in miserable condition outside and aren't being given the basic dignity of human beings. And that fact is something that they keep getting reminded of every time they come through and see us in their offices. And, you know, there's in a way, it's not an attempt to woo them with honey, but we've tried the honey approach, and no doubt others will try again. We're trying to use the stick, let somebody else play Bugs Bunny with the carrot. So this is an example of the kinds of behavior that the mayor thinks calls for the police department. You're going to hear conversations between three people. Myself, actually four people, Bernard Klitzner, who is another activist with Huff, and 82-year-old woman who is supporting us named Evelyn Schoenfeld, who is also in the office. She walks slowly. She's been fighting for a number of civil rights causes for many, many years, and she came down on Thursday morning to help us. Thursday morning was the same morning that the homeless memorial was held out at the Homeless Services Center, where the names of 37 dead homeless people for the last year were read. And while some of us were out there recording that, and we're hoping to have that available for a future tape, and talking about the protest and giving out flyers, Evelyn and Bernard were sitting in the offices of the city council. And then I came back and kind of told Evelyn and Bernard what had happened. And Anna Brooks is one of the two secretaries. Anna and Suzanne are the two secretaries there. I'm not sure if they're called office technicians or supervisors, but in fact, they sit at desks and do a lot of what looks like secretarial work, so I call them secretaries, with no disrespect intended. However, I do have a lot of disrespect for Anna Brooks's behavior. She treats people who are homeless adults or homeless activist adults as though they were six-year-olds with a hearing impediment, and she does so routinely, regularly, and loudly, and with no apparently censure or control from her boss, which I have to assume is City Manager Dick Wilson, and I assume she has some responsibility to the city council members who also have offices in her building and who she supposedly is the sort of front desk for, the first stop for. If you want to see a city council member, you talk to Anna Brooks. Anyway, she had apparently made a big hubbub about a sign that disappeared from the office. It was a little, not a stiff, artistic sign or something. It was a piece of paper she'd written up on her machine, which announced that Becky Johnson was tape recording what's going on in the offices. And of course, the reason we've been tape recording is because Fitzmaurice has been claiming that we are harassing his workers, and we are trying to show that no, we're not. Here's an audio record that proves we're not harassing anybody. But when this little piece of paper disappeared from the window, apparently somebody took it, although it can easily be replaced, and I think that it was only probably good as long as Becky Johnson was in the office, and she left that day, and there was nobody, and she didn't come back, so I don't know why you would have wanted to say that Becky Johnson is audio recording in an office where she isn't. It would seem to be a misstatement. Anna dressed her down and then left me a long, nasty message on my answering machine. So, and then she also was informing the people that they were leaving a minute or two late. The office closes from 12 to 1, and she was very upset that she had to wait for these protesters to go get her lunch. And often, of course, she doesn't have to wait at all. She doesn't come out till 5 or 10 minutes after 12 or later. And it's a control freak kind of deal where she's browbeating people because she can. And or perhaps she just simply is obsessive about it. I don't know. But in any case, you get to hear this discussion, and it gives you an example of what the protesters are facing in the office and why we need your help. We need people to come and witness this kind of nonsense going on, peacefully, quietly, respectfully witness, so that if and when and the police came later and they took reports and they took pictures about all this as though there was some major crime, this you get to see a criminal behavior by the protesters in the Santa Cruz City Council offices. As soon as I get this tape properly queued up, I think we have the right tape here. I think this is it. Yeah, this is the right tape.
For something, this is the flyer.
So
you
did.
Oh, you have one. You do need to actually be out of the office at noon.
Okay.
At noon, a lot of times people will like wait till noon and then start
gathering
their belongings. You need to actually be out of the office at noon. So I just thought you could give you a little heads up.
Okay.
You'll need to leave it there. I've got something I need to.
I just want to let you know what it is, because it's maybe a little ambiguous.
Well, I'm just doing something harder, so you can come back after
that. Okay, it's all you can understand.
Great.
I have a number of
documents in this
file. Okay, I have explained to you before that if you want documents in the FYI file, you need to mark them with post-its. So maybe you can do that after lunch. I told you that before, Robert.
Okay.
Well, wait a minute. We still got about two more minutes
before
we have to get up. Let's. This belongs to our office. This is our office.
Absolutely right.
That's 82-year-old Evelyn Schoenfeld.
Getting swollen.
Well, I guess we have to finish outside, right?
Yes, better. We don't want to run afoul of the. If you could please hold this.
Oh, Robert, you need to take this. These were phone messages from yesterday.
Oh. Ooh.
Getting up, getting ready to leave. I'm writing on a message for one of the council members. Preparing just the copies to be made.
Bye, Suzanne. See you soon.
Bye,
For the record, we're leaving at 12:57,
that's
so as to avoid any unpleasant interactions with any of the staff. Be back. At 1 o'clock.
Goodbye.
And here is your pen with the name City Manager's Office, 809 Center Street, Green 10, Santa Cruz, California, typed on the pen and actually scotch tape too.
The point here is that Anna has typed the name of the city council offices to these 29-cent pens because several of them apparently have been taken, and she wants to emphasize that she doesn't want to lose pens. And I commented on this, and she replied.
One would think the cost of doing that would actually be more than...
That happened, Robert,
itself.
Because we continually have people pilfering pens from our office.
I'd be happy to give you a couple of pens, Anna. I'd be happy to bring some for you if you'd like.
You just need to not take ones that don't belong
I
to you.
I don't think that's an appropriate thing to say to a member of the public, Anna, and I will be writing you up for that.
And, of course, I was joking when I said writing you up for that, but I was kidding on the square because Fitzmaurice frequently comes out and has to for Bernard Klitzner and Becky Johnson, and I guess for myself as well, and said, I want you to write up these people for not leaving the office when I asked them to leave. He has no right to demand we leave the office. In fact, it's a form of intimidation, but he is somehow trying to show that we're engaging in bad behavior, and so he's making a series of memos as a paper trail. So my response was to suggest that I would write Anna up for suggesting that members of the public are stealing her property, specifically that we are stealing her property without any evidence that it's us. It's trivial stuff, but one tries to, turnabout is fair play.
Ready to go?
Yeah.
They said, if you want extra pens, we'll be happy to provide them for you. Just don't accuse people of theft. Thank you. The amount of energy you put into this is completely ridiculous.
Wait.
Let me see
the wallet to Anna.
Yeah, let's get her purse. Hustling an 82-year-old woman out of the office like this is also not a particularly commendable achievement, Anna. Here you go.
I'd like someone to hold this.
All right. And I'll take this along. See you too later.
Thanks.
All righty.
I have work to do to manage.
So we are outside the offices.
And that bit of behavior, the conversation you heard between me and Anna, and as I sort of helped 82-year-old Evelyn out of the office, and as we left, that became the basis for a disturbing the peace complaint that police officers, a sergeant and a CSO, interviewed us about over a period of a half an hour to an hour and took photographs about when we returned at 1 o'clock later that afternoon. I may have some of that tape available too. It's a clear example of intimidation. I haven't been charged with disturbing the peace, but we were threatened with being charged with disturbing the peace because I was advising one of the secretaries that her behavior was offensive, that I didn't like being accused of being a thief or stealing pens, that I wouldn't mind, you know, replacing her pens, but that I think it's simply standing up for one's rights before bureaucrats and public officials, not letting one's dignity be routinely battered down. Now, Fitzmaurice, when he comes out of the office and sees us, says, "Stop harassing my staff." And when we say to him, "Look, deal with the issue at hand. We don't care to harass your staff. Of course, if your staff is nasty or inappropriate or talks down to us, I mean, they'll probably get something back in like kind. I mean, although we're much less likely to do it than they are because we have to pay the consequences more than they do because we are vulnerable and the staff is being supported by the city council, politicians, and police. Not that the staff is really at fault for anything in any larger sense. They're just like the police, thrown in as a kind of an intermediary way, and friction is created. So here's a little more from the City Council Coffee Klatch back on Thursday.
And it's an outside room 10 at about 12:59. I mean 11:59, I should say. And I'm with Evelyn and with Bernard. Let's see. Well, that was pretty much it. They met for about half an hour. There was media there from Channel 46.
And I'm giving a briefing about what happened at the Homeless Services Center memorial reading of the dead.
Ken Cole did most of the talking. One homeless man named Daryl read a poem, which was good, and I also got his poem later on tape, so we were able to actually get an intelligible
Ken
copy.
Give any signal to us that he's ready to be a real activist.
Did Ken Cole give a signal that he was ready to be a real activist?
To be a real activist. Was there any signal in his discussion that would
tell
us?
He did allow David Silva to make a long speech, and he allowed me to make a long speech, and I would say not particularly himself. He's not moving. I think he sees his job as a very limited one. So
he's probably not. So he just wants to be an apologist for the system right now. That's
all
he is.
I think it's something in the middle. I think he sees his position as being running social services, and he feels like he butts his head against the wall. He doesn't like me particularly. He doesn't feel we're very effective as activists. He doesn't see us effectively organizing homeless people, and we're not. We don't have a lot of homeless people organized. I did make a speech that invited people to come down here at 1 o'clock, and people broke up into little groups and began talking after that. They milled around for about 15 or 20 minutes. The Sentinel reporter asked to interview me. The Channel 46 reporter, who turned out to be a homeless man, which is interesting enough, interviewed me. I sent him over to Fitzmaurice afterwards to interview him. What I failed to do, I was getting a little feistier toward Fitzmaurice toward the end, because we were now back to business as usual once the memorial was over. It was, as far as I'm concerned, Fitzmaurice is the vote. He's not just the vote. He's the mayor that won't put this item on the agenda. So he is the key person here. And you'll notice in the flyer, at Becky's suggestion, it says, it doesn't say city council offices, it says Tim Fitzmaurice's office, because that's what I'm calling this, the Fitzmaurice office, because that's where he's really the key person here. But it is also all the other city council members as well.
Well, who said...
So, wait a minute. Can you finish your report? Go ahead, finish your report. Anything else interesting that we should be aware of?
Two out-of-towners from Utah who came all the way to town when they heard about the sleeping van, who are homeless. One of them in a wheelchair named Zane, an older man, and his companion, a fellow named Gentle, have slept overnight at Becky's house, and they went out there with us, Zane spoke. He went out in his wheelchair and he said,
articulate.
I can't. He was very articulate. And there was general feeling, I don't think that any people there are any more likely to show up at 1 o'clock than before, but I'm going to bring pastries and coffee just to be sure. I'm going to go down and get some during the noon break.
Well, these people, are they coming? The people in that you just
said? Believe so. I believe he's coming. We'll probably get a couple people at least. So I think that there'll be a certain number of people here.
I have a question to ask of you. Who said didn't know how to organize a homeless?
And indeed, on Thursday afternoon and Friday, there was considerable turnout at city council offices. I think we doubled our numbers. We had 4 or 5 people throughout the day, and I guess that number of people is likely to return on Tuesday. I'll probably be at the Veterans Hall tomorrow at noon with my usual flyering, and we got a couple of interesting Christmas carols coming up, which I'm going to try a little a cappella singing here, so turn down your radios, folks, because this is these are some Christmas carols. They're appropriate for Santa Cruz. Each year we write up some of these carols. Carol Denny began some of them, and then Becky Johnson and I began writing them. Linda LeMasters contributed. Long ago, as I guess when Mayor Rotkin was mayor way back when, but this is about Fitzmaurice and about his council. It goes like this. Away on vacation, no time for the poor. Lord Mayor Fitzmaurice left them out of doors. 37 dead homeless throughout the last year. Alas, quoth the mayor, the poor are so dear. The last council meeting has come and has gone, but the law against sleeping goes on and goes on. The mayor made sure that there would be no change, though the council agenda was his to arrange. 160 is all we can take. The shelters told the mayor there's people at stake. So 1 to 2,000 are out on the street, dodging police and troll busters in winter so deep. The death toll is rising, 37 this year. The mayor Fitzmaurice wipes away a quick tear, then turns to protesters with growl and with sneer. Get out of the office, you're not wanted here. Protesters are coming from across the land to fight the oppression of the sleeping ban. To cover with blankets cannot be a crime. We'll gather together and beat it this time. There are actually many more verses. Some talk about the history of it. Last summer Fitzmaurice got burned, you must know. His timid, safe sleeping zones didn't go with the flow. The Harvey West business has raised a mighty great roar. Said they get the homeless away from our door. Fitzmaurice and Sugar and Crone makes a third, slunk swiftly away, though the reason's absurd. Texas Instruments, Plantronics, and Mission Street fears were louder than pain or the homeless man's tears. With hundreds of fasters and hundreds of calls, the cry for swift justice filled City Council its halls. For Crone and Fitzmaurice, the election's our deal. They struck off the ballot the sleeping ban repeal. Yes. Well, I actually had some better lyrics, but hey, we're working with them, and I think this kind of singing is to the point around Christmas. There's some other ones. For example, let's see here. You better not sleep, you better not lie, don't snooze in the cruise, I'm telling you why. Sleeping's not allowed for the poor. The cops have a list, they're checking it twice, if it's warrants you've got, they're not very nice. Sleeping's not allowed for the poor. They'll find you if you're sleeping, they'll ID you if you're awake. It's $100 each time you rest, so be gone, for goodness sake. Hey, they're slashing your tent, you better run far, they're taking you in, they're towing your car. Santa Cruz says, get out of town. So, that's a good one. And of course there's the classic tune, which I only have the first verse for. Let's see if I remember it. You know, I think I'll do is I'll ask my producer, if she's listening, to call in and sing that verse, because she's got a better voice than I do for that particular stuff. Maybe you can call in with your own verses here for Santa Cruz, Christmas Santa Cruz style. Here's a story from New York City. New York homeless man given a final gift. It was a final Christmas gift for the man they called the Chief. Snowflakes fell on the two fire engines parked across the street from the funeral home in Harlem on Friday, while inside, firefighters wearing rubber boots sat on folding chairs, bidding a final farewell to Alex Davis. No one really knew how old he was. The death certificate said 56, but everyone guessed he was in his late 70s. One thing was certain. Lying in a donated coffin wearing a dark suit and white carnation was the best Davis had been dressed in decades. Reminds me of the cardboard coffins we brought to City Council commemorating the death of Boxer Billy, who died of exposure here in Santa Cruz in the last 2 months, along with 37 others who died on the streets, as we've talked about before. The homeless man with a vague past had shown up sometime during the 1960s, no one quite remembers when, near Engine Company 82 and Ladder 31 in the South Bronx. Davis said he was from the Carolinas, had served in the Merchant Marine. He didn't say much more. He started sweeping the sidewalk outside the firehouse. When the engines left to answer the alarms, he kept the neighborhood kids from bothering firefighters' cars. He became a fixture there. Every day he sat in front of the firehouse in his own special chair, which the firefighters took in at night. He had a kind of mayoral status on the corner, said Neil Walsh, an 18-year-old veteran of the department. At night, Davis retired to vacant buildings, or more recently to an abandoned big rig trailer. Not in Santa Cruz. That would have been illegal. For 3 decades, the 50 firefighters of Engine Company 82 cared for him. Davis even appeared in the firehouse's official Millennium Group portrait. We kept him alive by feeding him. He ate numerous Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners. We clothed him, Walsh said. He was here every day, sun up to sun down. His nickname for everyone was Chief, Walsh said. That's how he got his nickname. About 2 weeks ago, the firefighters responded to a report of a man lying face down in a vacant lot. It was their friend. He had frozen to death during the night. Unable to locate any family, firefighters took up a collection and bought a cemetery plot in New Jersey for Davis. The casket and suit were donated. Almost every firefighter showed up Friday. The greatest test of a person's character is what they will do for somebody, the Reverend Herman Watts said during the funeral. And that's about the death of Chief in New York City. And interestingly enough, it was a story from the Austin American Statesman. And the Austin American Statesman is a newspaper for Austin, Texas, one of the three or four cities whose courts have overturned the sleeping ban. And that's still been overturned.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Okay. Here's the song.
Uh-oh.
God rest ye merry gentlemen, but not in Santa Cruz. Fitzmaurice has a sleeping ban, he'll cite you if you snooze. And if you're warm beneath your quilts, your blankets you shall lose. Bad tidings, not comfort or joy, comfort or joy. Bad tidings, not comfort or joy.
Very good, very good. We've got to get some more verses to that one.
Okay. We'll work on it.
Hey, thank you.
I hope everyone turns out Tuesday, 10 o'clock, room 10 at the City Hall complex.
Yeah, 809 Center Street. All righty.
That's the place.
Thank you.
And here's a story from the Los Angeles Times. South L.A. curfew sweeps to be enforced by sheriff, LAPD. In an effort to curb crime in one of the toughest areas in South Los Angeles, law enforcement officials announced a strategy Friday that will focus on forcibly taking juvenile curfew offenders off the streets. Citing a rise in homicides in that area this year, Sheriff Lee Baca described a concerted effort by the Sheriff's Department and two LAPD divisions, Southeast and 77th. The sweeps will take individuals under 18 off the streets between 10 p.m. and sunrise using a law enforcement mobile unit. Officers in the 77th Division have already been conducting periodic curfew sweeps, but this effort will be far broader. And you thought martial law was only for Nazi Germany or wartime. Well, think again. If you're under 18, time to be extra careful. A news conference was held by Councilman Mark Ridley Thomas and attended by Supervisor Yvonne Brathwaite Burke, numerous law enforcement officials, local clergy and community members, in the parking lot of a Winchell's Donut Shop at Imperial Highway and Normandy Avenue, where two young men were killed 5 weeks ago. Captain Sam Jones of the Sheriff's Lenox Station will be in charge of coordinating the effort. He will schedule periodic curfew sweeps and enlist the support of juvenile court judges. A mobile unit will be used to take juveniles to specified locations instead of jail. Parents will then be called to pick them up, and they could be required to attend parenting classes. In addition to going after potential troublemakers, the sweeps will try to keep youths who could become victims of crime off the streets, Jones said. The curfew was already in place, he said, but it was not being vigorously enforced. That's, get this straight, people will be taken off the streets because of their age, not because of anything they're doing, not because of any connection with a crime, not even because an ongoing crime is threatening them, although you would presumably not want to take somebody off the streets in these United States of America without their permission unless they're asking for your help. No, this is a curfew in peacetime. And instead of dealing with the realities behind what creates this crime, they are giving the police more power simply to treat people as though they were under a military occupation. This is police state activity. And we have a curfew in Santa Cruz as well. It's for people under 16. And it hasn't been vigorously enforced, but it has been enforced. As we heard from a number of young people who came and talked to us at the City Council Coffee Klatch, in the first few days of the Coffee Klatch, a number of people from one of the local, I think they called it the Bay Children's College, came and talked about how they had been, one guy had been hogtied, other people had been stopped under the curfew for skateboarding, that it was the kind of behavior that the police engaged in was outrageous. I think they were talking about SCPD activity, our own Santa Cruz Police Department. So it's not just happening down in dirty, deadly, nasty old Los Angeles. It's happening here too. And unless we stop it before it gets bigger, it will consume us as well. And also some bad news from Los Angeles. Rampart's verdicts voided. Rampart's, as you know, is probably know, is the station in Los Angeles out of which more than 100 bogus arrests, phony perjured testimony from police officers, concocted convictions, brutalization and manipulation of cases so that people were innocent people were sent away for years to jail to justify the cowboy activities of LAPD cops. Three of these cops were convicted, and that conviction was just overturned by a judge down there, and this is what happened. In an unusual move, a Los Angeles Superior Court judge on Friday threw out the convictions of three LA police officers accused of framing gang members and granted them new trials. The convictions were the first obtained by prosecutors in the sweeping year-long city police corruption scandal. In tossing them out, the trial judge, Jacqueline Connor, cited insufficient evidence and juror errors. Sergeants Edward Ortiz and Brian Liddy and Officer Michael Buchanan, were found guilty November 15th of conspiring to frame gang members. They were the first officers prosecuted in an ongoing probe into corruption in LAPD's Ramparts Division. Actually, Rampart Division. We're all amazed when the system works, said lawyer Harlan Braun, who represented Buchanan. This was a mistaken verdict, and it was a miscarriage of justice. I'm glad it was overturned by Christmas. He added that he had not yet read the lengthy decision, which he received word of late Friday night. The judge's ruling was absolutely correct and just, said Barry Levin, attorney for Ortiz. Given the emotion and controversy surrounding this case, her decision was courageous. Attorney Winston Kevin McKesson, who represents ex-cop-turned-informant Rafael Perez, said he was disappointed by the ruling. However, it's really not surprising when you consider that what was at issue in this case went to the very heart of the criminal justice system, McKesson said. I think it is very difficult for this judge, who has spent the vast majority of her adult life in that system, to allow a jury decision that questions the system to stand. I think she felt threatened by the jury's verdict. Connor issued the opinion before leaving town for a week's vacation. The lengthy decision came after 5 weeks of filings and hearings in which defense attorneys sought to undo the historic verdict. The officers were convicted of conspiracy for making up a story that they were hit in 1996 by a truck driven by gang members. The Rampart scandal has resulted in the suspension of dozens of officers and the overturning of about 100 tainted cases. So far, only 5 officers, including Liddy, Buchanan, and Ortiz, have been charged criminally. One officer, Paul Harper, was acquitted. A 5th, Nino Durden, is awaiting trial. Connor's ruling is expected to make future prosecutions even more difficult. District Attorney Steve Cooley could not be reached for comment late Friday, but his spokeswoman, Sandy Gibbons, said prosecutors had not yet been formally informed of the judge's ruling. If indeed the news reports are true, we are very, very disappointed, Gibbons said. She said prosecutors would need to carefully study Connor's ruling before deciding whether to refile a case against any or all the officers. This won't be an immediate decision, Gibbons said. Former District Attorney Gil Garcetti, who oversaw the prosecution of the officers before being voted out of office last month, said it was extremely disappointing to hear what she's done. Garcetti said he was not entirely surprised by the judge's ruling, but I'll reserve comment beyond that. The verdicts quickly came under question by the defense. The first problem involved allegations, as say the verdicts before they were overturned by the judge. The first problem involved allegations of juror misconduct. An alternate claimed that on the first day of trial, the foreman told her and another alternate that the defendants were guilty. The foreman on the second alternate testified that they don't remember any such comment, and the jury convicted the officers after agreeing that the three had not suffered great bodily injury, but the officers never claimed they suffered great bodily injury. A computer-generated police report relied on during deliberations incorrectly exaggerated the severity of injuries the officers said they received. Defense attorneys have affidavits from 5 jurors attesting that they were confused by the report. The jurors did not simply misunderstand great bodily injury, Connor wrote in her decision. In fact, the evidence suggests that they understood, however, the definition of great bodily injury and its existence or non-existence was never part of the dispute in the trial. Whether they exaggerated their injuries or lied about the extent of those injuries was never charged in any overt act, any allegation, or any of the counts, Connor ruled. The judge was sharply critical of the DA's handling of the case and cited media reports as contributing to an incorrect verdict. This court cannot and should not consider the political ramifications of future lawsuits or future prosecutions, Connor added. The defense in this case has presented compelling evidence to support their argument that the defendants did not receive a fair trial. In her concluding paragraph, the judge said, "Well, the court cannot and will not presume to guess whether a correction of the errors would result in any different verdict. It most certainly concludes that the verdict in this case cannot stand." So they threw out the verdicts against the three bad, corrupt cops in the Rampart Division. It's hard to believe they were anything other than corrupt, given the testimony that was presented at that trial. It looks like technicalities here are involved. Usually I'm on the side of the defendants, and I like to apply a single standard, whether the defendants are police officers or people being victimized by the police. I think it's important to be fair in any case. And I wasn't on the jury, and I wasn't in the courtroom, but from what I read in the newspaper accounts, this was only a small part of the case, and to have this be the basis for which the conviction is thrown out, I certainly hope it is retried quickly. And there's a second story on this issue, and again in the Los Angeles Times. Parks vows to seek new convictions of Rampart officers. "This is not over by a long shot," the police chief says, after a judge overturned the jury's verdict in the trial of three officers. Prosecutors will study their options. Reeling from a judge's decision to toss out convictions of three LAPD officers, police reform advocates angrily complained Saturday while Police Chief Bernard C. Parks vowed to pursue convictions a second time. This is the same guy, of course, who covered up the scandal and held back on the scandal for years. So I don't know how confident we should feel about that. "This is not over by a long shot," Parks said in an interview. "It is unfortunate that we've gone through a trial of this length and depth and then have to go through it again, but we'll be prepared to refile if necessary. The convictions of the three officers last month were a boost to the investigations of LAPD corruption and signaled..."